Yes, so who is the Buddha? So I thought I'd just start off by talking about some things from my own life, especially my own life in Buddhist practice. So I was taught to meditate about 23 years ago, it was now, 23, 24 years ago. And I was taught by people from the London Buddhist Centre, but I wasn't actually taught at the London Buddhist Centre. What they had done was they had hired a little room in central London and were teaching there, and that's where I went to learn to meditate. And it was, so I learned in a very secular setting. It was just a little hired room, a bit like one of the classrooms, say, here. And yeah, just very plain, really. There was a little bunch of flowers in an empty Perrier bottle, I remember that. And there was some incense, but I didn't really think too much of those things. I thought, well, flowers, that's nice. And, well, to tell the truth, I thought that the incense was there to hide the smell of people's feet, because we'd all been asked to take our shoes off before coming in. And again, I simply thought, well, you know, we're sitting on the floor, it'll be more comfortable with our shoes off. So I didn't think there was anything behind this incense or taking our shoes off other than quite practical reasons. And I learned to meditate on a 6-week course, really, really enjoyed it. I was particularly very, very struck by the person who was teaching the meditation, and I realised he was a Buddhist and I wanted to learn more about Buddhism. So he said to the group at the end, he said, well, if you want to know more, come to the London Buddhist Centre and you find out a bit more. So I was very keen to learn a bit more. Went along to the London Buddhist Centre, went into the room where we were going to be taught, and I was absolutely horrified, because there in the room, and many of you will have seen the rooms at the London Buddhist Centre, was this most enormous Buddha statue with something that looked suspiciously like a halo around its head. And I didn't like this at all. As a matter of fact, I so didn't like it that I used to deliberately sit with my back to it at all times, out of protest. Not that anybody probably noticed, but I was making my sort of silent protest. And, well, I didn't like it because for me it reminded me of something that I had left behind. When I was a little girl, well, when I was born, really, I think ever since I was born I was a Catholic and very, very devout, practicing Catholic. I had realised I didn't believe in God when I was about 11, so I suppose I stopped being a Catholic then. But for me, what had that was quite a major experience for me. But that, in a way, that wasn't the most disturbing thing for me. The most disturbing things happened, I became aware of, when I was in my later teens, and certainly at the particular church in a little Scottish village where I was practicing. I saw, well, just really quite a lot of quite kind of cruel things happen, quite divisive things happen in the name of religion at that time then. So I had decided that I didn't want to have anything more to do with organised religion again in my life. I had really turned against it quite vehemently. And so, yeah, so to walk in and see this Buddha statue really quite appalled me. Only the fact that, you know, the people teaching me seemed to make sense. In some ways it was quite hard to make sense of both experiences. I was really drawn to these people teaching me, and yet there was this thing that really, you know, was a total turn-off, really, to me. It wasn't, I didn't think I wanted that at all. So that was about 23 years ago. So 8 years after that, I was about to become ordained into our order, now called the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. We changed our name recently. We used to be called the Western Buddhist Order. So I was about to be ordained into that order. And I had a pressing problem that I was a bit scared to tell anybody about, because I thought if I told anyone, especially the other order members, and most especially the order member who was going to ordain me, conduct the ordination. If I told her what this thing was, I wouldn't be allowed to be ordained. And the thing that I was worried about was I was having a stronger and stronger desire to pray to the Buddha. And I thought, it was very, very strong within me that I wanted to pray to the Buddha, but I thought if I tell them, they won't think I'm a Buddhist, they'll think I'm still a Catholic, really, I won't be allowed to be ordained. So I thought I just wanted to explore those two things in the talk, really. How I had, you know, I'd started off by turning my back on the Buddha, and then I had wanted to pray to the Buddha. Both of them, in a way, were problems to me. So I wanted to at least start off by talking with how I resolved both those things. Because I have resolved them, I'm sure, in a sense, actually, the process of resolution is ongoing, but I have to, I would say, to a sort of effective level, resolve them. Now I don't sit with my back to the shrine, I even bow to the shrine. And yeah, I'm very, you know, well, actually delighted by this lovely shrine that we've got here. And I have been ordained, so I didn't not get ordained. This wish to pray to the Buddha wasn't in the end the problem that I thought it was. I eventually did pluck up the courage to tell my preceptor, the woman order member who was going to ordain me, and in fact it turned out not to be a problem at all. It was a problem within my own mind. And I think, when I think, these two things, although they seem almost the opposite problem in a way, I think there is a connection between these two things. When I was thinking about them, both these issues that were causing me trouble had at their root, they were both really a case of taking the image or the symbol of the Buddha too literally. So I took it too literally when I wanted to sit with my back to it. I also took it too literally when I thought that wanting to pray to the Buddha was a problem that would get in the way of me being a Buddhist, as it were. So yeah, so that's what I want to explore in this talk, who is the Buddha? So I hope I can do that. I hope I can communicate. I was saying to the others on the team, I feel like this is the talk I keep trying to give in a way, to try and communicate something about this. Well, it's a kind of spiritual dilemma, I think. So I hope I can do that. So who is the Buddha? So, well, the Buddha is, the image of the Buddha is rather unmissable on the shrine here. And we have, when we've been entering the shrine room, we've been saluting the shrine. We've been bowing before this image of the Buddha. So what, that's the first thing I want to say. Well, what does that mean? Why do we have this shrine? Why do Buddhists bow before a shrine of the Buddha? So I thought I'd explore this on different levels. So the sort of first level of who is the Buddha, of bowing before the Buddha, is the sort of historical, the Buddha as a historical figure. So, and it's the bowing is an expression of gratitude to the Buddha as a historical figure. So, as far as we know, the Buddha was born in northern India about 2,500 years ago. He was a historical character who, through his own efforts, gave what we called enlightenment. I'll say more about what we mean by enlightenment soon. When he was still a relatively young man, about 30, he gained enlightenment. And then for the next 50 years of his life, he taught. He really wanted to share the truth that he discovered with other people. So what the Buddha was as a young man immediately concerned about was really a sort of the existential issues of life. So the Buddha was was moved by his own experience. Buddhism came from the experience of the Buddha. As a young man, he was asking himself questions like some of us might have asked ourselves, like, well, what's the use of everything? What's the use of youth, health, wealth, etc., if we're so lucky to have those things, when it's all going to end in death? So he went forth, we say, to try and explore these questions and try and find an answer to these questions, to try and find if there was something beyond that. And that's what you could say the state of enlightenment is something beyond that, something that finds its expression in wisdom, in compassion, in energy, in freedom. And the Buddha didn't want to just explore that for himself. As soon as he had found something that he thought was really worth sharing, he just totally wanted to share that with whoever wanted to listen. His teaching was freely given. He was a very, very skilled communicator, we're told. He could meet all sorts of different people and communicate to them in ways that they could understand. So the Buddha was a teacher in actuality. So he taught for 50 years before he passed away at the age of 80. And then his teachings have also been handed down through those 2,500 years ago, first of all through the oral tradition and then written down. To those of us who are practicing Buddhism today, those teachings have been handed down. So that's the first level of bowing to the Buddha. So when we see an image on the shrine of a Buddha, a Buddhist would feel gratitude. Or even if you didn't call yourself a Buddhist, you might still feel gratitude if you could feel gratitude that someone was trying to teach, was teaching wisdom and compassion and so on. So you could say the first level of bowing to the Buddha is one of gratitude. But then going a bit deeper, going to a bit of a deeper level, the whole notion or this whole actuality of the Buddha being someone who was born a human being is absolutely kind of of very, very central importance in Buddhism. The Buddha wasn't a sort of divine incarnation or anything like that. The Buddha was just born as an ordinary human being. And it was through his own efforts that he perfected all these qualities that I've mentioned and found a way to the end of suffering, found a way beyond this this existential problem of, what's it all about? What's it all about if we're all going to have to suffer and die in the end? So the Buddha was born as we are born. He overcame what we can overcome. He attained what we can attain. That's the implication of that. So this is what's got a very strong message for us, because then we can look at this level of what the Buddha represents as a symbol of what we can become. We can look at the Buddha as our own highest potential fulfilled, of anyone, of human potential fulfilled. So again, it's very central to the teaching of Buddhism that every single human being has got the potential for enlightenment. So every single human being has got the potential for perfection, you could say. So that, again, that's when we bow before the Buddha, you could say that's what we're bowing towards. We're bowing towards our own potential realised, our own potential to be completely wise, to have a panoramic awareness and perspective, to have a compassion that's, just overflowing, to have no selfishness left in us at all, to have a sort of boundless energy that always sees what needs to be done and is able to respond, to have a creativity that can just respond positively to whatever life throws up. So the message of the Buddha is that is attainable for any human being. So that's the next level of bowing to the Buddha. And I was thinking that is that's not the final level that I'm going to talk about, but it's very, very important. It's very, very important. I think that we really need a symbol so that we can have an imaginative connection of what we can become. I was thinking about this recently. I was thinking, people often come to the Buddha Center where I teach, and I often to learn to meditate, and I often ask them, well, what's brought you to meditate? And they quite often express that in sort of negative terms. What I mean by that is in terms of what they don't want anymore. So they might say, oh, I don't want to be stressed, I don't want to feel anxious, that kind of thing. That's what people very often say. Even, I think, even if they express it in positive terms, like they might say, oh, I want to be more calm, I still kind of get the sense that what they mean by that is they don't want to be stressed. So even though it might be expressed positively, it is, they're probably feeling it and they want the absence of stress, of feeling harried all the time. But I think myself, the more I think about it, unless we have a way of actually imaginatively connecting with the positive, then it is quite hard to change. I think quite often, and probably we also have that in our lives, quite often I feel that I have a connection with that in the form of a person. For example, I might think if I'm in a difficult situation, I might think something like, well, what would Jnanavacha do here? You know, or I might think, oh, what would Maitreya Banda say here? So in a way, to have that image of the positive can kind of somehow help me. And I think, oh yeah, I could be like that too. You know, do people recognise that sort of thing? You can sometimes, by imagining, thinking of a person that you look up to, or thinking of a person that you know responds well in a situation, it can help you. And I think that helps, because it helps us. It's almost like we need to know what it would look like. It's all very well to say, I don't want to be very stressed, but somehow if we don't quite know what it would look like not to be stressed, I think it's quite hard to move towards the positive. So that's one level of that. I think there's a deeper level of this too, because I think we need a positive image of what we're moving towards, because changing, like really changing, means letting go of our definition of ourself. So even if we've got habits that we don't like in ourselves, they kind of define us as well. We can be sort of comfortable with even our bad habits, or I know I certainly can. Like, I know for many years, one thing I've struggled with a lot and worked with and hopefully made a little bit of headway with is working with anger and irritation. It all started when I started to meditate. I often say that. I was perfectly nice before that. I'm very kind of friendly and docile. Anyway, after I learned to meditate, I had quite a number of quite angry years and felt quite a lot of anger and irritation. And I started to realise, well, this is going to have to change. This is going to have to stop. Because I started to notice the negative effect it was having on other people. That was one of my main incentives to change. But at the same time, I realised, and this was quite a shock to realise, that one of the things that was holding me back from really changing was I just didn't know who I'd be anymore. I actually, when I imagined myself without anger and irritation, I kind of didn't feel there'd be very much left. You know, I kind of had a bit of a sense of myself, of a sort of grey shadow of a person. I didn't know. It seemed to be such a big part of me that I thought, yeah, but who, yeah, there'll be nothing left, you know. There'll be just this sort of wisp of grey smoke, a sort of wraith-like sort of thing, you know. So, I mean, I really felt that, actually. And I thought, well, that's quite, no wonder it's hard to change, you know, because it's so tied up with who I am that even though I can see it's not particularly helping me, it's certainly not having a good effect on other people. There was an attachment to it as it defined myself. So I think that's an even deeper reason why we can need an imaginative, a positive image to move towards, because we need something to kind of replace, as it were, our old way of being. If we're trying to let go of an old habit or way of being, we need to know that there'll be something. Well, we need something to move towards. Well, I certainly do. I found it certainly was essential to me to have something to move towards. So again, for me, the figure of the Buddha with these perfected human qualities is something that very much helps me in the sense of, well, that's something I can move towards. And, well, again, myself, I don't even know if one has to be a Buddhist to respond to the image of the Buddha and to respond to those qualities, because they do seem to me to be very, very human qualities, these ones I've mentioned. I can't imagine, in a way, not wanting to be wise or not wanting to be compassionate. Okay, so that was all me. I think it was realising all these things that helped me turn around to face the Buddha, basically. All that, starting to realise, first of all, the gratitude of the Buddha, as I learned more about the Buddha, the feeling of gratitude, and also as I started to connect with it as an embodiment of my own and everyone else's human potential, I felt I could turn around and face the Buddha and bow to the Buddha. And that went a long way. So that's all good. But it's not really completely it. From a Buddhist point of view, it still hasn't completely answered who is the Buddha. It's still, even though that's all true, everything that I said, it's still limited. It's not completely it. So this next bit of the talk is it, as it were. I hope I can communicate something of what I mean by it. What time is it? Oh, good. Okay, so I think the sort of clue for me, that sort of personal thing I mentioned about wanting to pray to the Buddha, I think the clue as to what this it is lies in there. And when I say pray, what my feeling of prayer was, it wasn't prayer in the petitionary way. I remember as a Catholic girl, I used to sometimes pray in that petitionary way. It was more prayer in the sense of worship. I wanted to, sort of give thanks, as it were. It was prayer in that worshipful way that I felt like doing. So when I felt that, so what was going on when I felt that? So who or what was I praying to? I certainly, in wanting to pray, I certainly felt the presence of something that was bigger than me, something that was wiser than me, and something that even seemed to be helping or guiding me. I definitely felt that. And Buddhism teaches that if we're engaged in serious spiritual practice, actually spiritual as opposed to just religious rites and rituals, if we're engaged in serious spiritual practice, that we will encounter this. If we engage with practice, we will sooner or later feel the presence, either gradually or maybe even more like an eruption of something bigger than ourselves into our imagination. So I'm just going to say a little bit, because I brought in that word imagination, I'm just going to say a little bit about that and then come back to my main theme. Because when I'm talking about imagination here, I'm not just talking about, say, writing poems or making stories or making art, although it would include that. I'm including in imagination the ability to step into other's shoes, so the ability to empathise, so that's the basis of ethics, really, isn't it? And in a sort of bigger sense, I'm talking about imagination as the faculty that apprehends and responds to beauty, and also to spiritual truths. So that faculty that can respond to spiritual truths. So that faculty that can recognise kindness. And that faculty that can feel remorse, you know, when we haven't lived up to our best. That faculty that really feels that. that faculty that is uplifted by art or by nature. I really liked it when last night when Jaka reminded us to enjoy the snow and not just see it as something that stopped the trains running. So that faculty that can feel uplifted by nature. So Buddhism, or I certainly believe any sort of true spiritual path, would say that there is such a thing as spiritual truth as well as scientific truth, and that they're both means of knowing. The scientific truths are conceptual and they're understood by our faculty of reason, and that spiritual truths, I've kind of put that in inverted commas for want of a better word, but spiritual truths are symbolic and they're directly apprehended by our imagination or our imaginal faculty, and that we need both, and that both can be developed. So everybody's got the faculty of imagination. Certainly we've all got it as a potential. And it really is the essential vehicle, and this is what we're sort of theming this retreat around. It really is the essential vehicle of any genuine aesthetic and spiritual life. And we need to feed it. You know, it's there in potential. It might be a bit developed, or might be much more developed in some of us than others. We need to feed it, and we can feed it, which I find quite exciting. We can actually, we can actually help it to grow both in range and also vitality. And the more we can do that, then the more we'll increase the significance of the part that it plays in our lives. So that's what we're trying to do in leading the spiritual life. That's one way we could look at leading the spiritual life. We're trying to develop this imaginal faculty. I was thinking, last night we had a ritual, most of us were here, and one of the lines in it was, "May our mind become Buddha." And I was thinking, perhaps this is what we mean when we say that. What does that mean, may our mind become Buddha? You can say that means that we've really developed this imaginal faculty to its fullest flowering. Then our mind would have become Buddha. So that was just me sort of taking off just to fill out what I meant by imagination. And I was saying that because I had just been saying that I'd just been sort of throwing out to you that if we're engaged in a sort of serious spiritual practice, that we will naturally encounter something that feels bigger than ourselves. Yeah. So then what I'm interested in is, well, how do we respond to that? How do we respond either to the experience, or how do we even respond to me saying this here? How do you respond to me saying that? In a way, I'm sort of positing something quite strong, of something erupting into our minds. And Buddhism says that this is a crucial thing, how we respond to either this happening or even the thought of this happening. So if we do have such an experience and we sort of literalise it. So, for example, if we have an experience of something that seems bigger than us, and we say, okay, well, that definitely proves that there's definitely a God up there who definitely exists and is a being in the sky sort of thing, then Buddhism would say that was an extreme view and that wouldn't lead to enlightenment. If, on the other hand, you listen to this thinking, well, you know, I don't believe any of this. There's nothing sort of bigger. It's just my own mind. This is a kind of a load of rubbish, basically, she's talking about. Buddhism would say that's also an extreme view. So that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because Buddhism's saying that to think that there's definitely, if we have such an experience, that it's definitely something, that's an extreme view. And Buddhism's also saying, if we think that there's definitely nothing, that's also an extreme view. So I think that's quite exciting and very mysterious and quite challenging, because we're really used to thinking, well, it's either something or nothing, what else is there? And Buddhism is saying, well, actually there is something more mysterious and exciting. So Buddhism is saying that there are no eternal essences whatsoever, but that doesn't reduce everything to mere matter or leave us with a nihilistic denial of value and meaning. The Buddha taught what's called a middle way, and that middle way is over and above those two extremes. So it's not a midpoint between those two extremes, it's something over and above that is sort of more panoramic than those two extremes. We're not going to be able to understand that with our rational minds, because all our rational minds are going to go is, well, they're just going to go back to this thing, but it's either there or not there. That's all our rational minds can do. And for a Buddhist, that's the real reason why we meditate, why we practice ethics and so on. We practice those things in order to have a fit mind to be able to start to, well, explore and apprehend what I'm trying to say, which can't adequately be said in concepts or words. That's why, in a way, probably that's why I'm struggling to convey it, because actually it can't really be talked about in words. It can only be apprehended through this imaginal faculty that I'm talking about, through our mind that's been made more malleable by meditation. So, and this is what I think so far, that's what I think is the sort of deepest thing we're doing when we contemplate the image of the Buddha. Probably in a few years I'll say, oh well, you know, there's an even deeper reason yet, but this is as far as I've got. That when we're contemplating the image of the Buddha, either like an actual image or maybe we're even imagining the Buddha in our imaginations, we're not contemplating the creator of the universe or cosmic judge or any sort of eternal god. But we're also not just looking at a human being sort of bounded by a simple life, single lifespan. The Buddha kind of hovers above, as it were, our conceptual comprehension. The Buddha really is an expression of something very, very mysterious. When we talk about this middle way, we're talking about something very, very mysterious. So another way of saying this is that the image of the Buddha, so say this image of the Buddha on the shrine, is like a gateway or like a springboard that's pointing towards it, pointing beyond itself. So it's a gateway pointing beyond itself. It's not just the simple image. You see, the Buddha doesn't actually look like that, as it were. There was a lovely quote I came across by Picasso. I think this conveys something of what I'm trying to say. So Picasso says, there are painters who transform the sun into a yellow spot, but there are others, thanks to their art and their intelligence, who transform a yellow spot into the sun. Yeah, good. So that's hopefully conveying what I'm trying to say. So we're not trying to sort of bring the Buddha down, as it were, to the image, but the image is trying to draw us beyond itself to the Buddha. So you can see that the image is transparent. You look through it. You look through it to try and apprehend the ineffable, the indescribable. And here's a mysterious thing I'm going to say, it's as if, as well as us looking through it, it's as if there's a movement downwards from a dimension beyond the individual me or the individual anyone. But as soon as you ask, but does that mean it really exists then? Then you've immediately reduced it. You've taken the symbol for the mystery, which is, you know, meant to be the doorway. You've made the symbol into the end. So that's what we've got to try, and Buddhism saying to try and avoid the temptation to ask that question, actually, does it really exist? The Buddhist teaching actually doesn't deal in existence and non-existence as absolute categories. The Buddha would much more be inclined to speak of becoming and passing away, so there's more movement, there's a more flow, it's more like a verb. In fact, actually, what the Buddha is actually bothered about isn't how the universe came into existence and all that. I remember I used to ask that all the time of my mum. I used to say, well, who made the universe? And she said, well, God made the universe. And I said, well, who made God then? And she'd say, well, he's God. Nobody needed to make him. And I was so unsatisfied with that. And I was so unsatisfied that I went to study science in the end, because I thought that would give me the answers. And that still didn't give me the answers. I thought at the time it didn't give me the answers just because I wasn't clever enough, or just because I was smoking too much cannabis when I was meant to be studying. But actually now I think that I was asking the wrong questions. I was asking the question, well, how did the universe come into existence? When actually the Buddha says, actually, Buddha's basically saying, don't bother about that. He's saying that's an unanswerable question, and it's based on a sort of wrong premise in the first place. What the Buddha's more bothered about is, well, if he wants to talk about distinctions, he's talking about the distinction between, say, ignorance and wisdom, between ethically skillful and ethically unskillful. They're the distinctions that matter in Buddhism, i.e. how we live our life. I had that experience. I was teaching an introductory course at the Buddhist Centre, and one young woman on the course, her question at the beginning of the course was, what is the purpose of life? And at the end of the course I said, oh, have you got any new perspective on your questions? And she said, yes, I've realised that wasn't my question. I've realised my question was, how can I live a meaningful life? And I was really pleased, because I thought, oh, that felt to me like the course had, you know, had sort of worked in some sense. That Buddhism's concerned, yeah, not so much about the meaning of life, but about meaning in life. It's about finding meaning in our life. So I thought I'd perhaps impress you with the sort of big words to explain this. So you could say that the Buddha's distinctions are epistemological and ethical rather than ontological. So to do with knowing, to do with how we behave, rather than, yeah, this, there are other than distinctions of existence or non-existence. And just to emphasise that when we see the Buddha as a gateway or a springboard, it's for our own imaginations, that we can only imagine the Buddha wholeheartedly by discovering his image in our own minds. These images that surround us, and we're going to introduce you to more images as the retreat goes on, they're supporting that, but they're not it. They're helping to, they're helping to spark off our own imaginations. If we want to imagine the Buddha, and Buddhism would say that that's essential to imagine the Buddha if we want to become the Buddha, then we need to do that within our own imaginations. And that's exactly what the early disciples of the Buddha would have done. After the Buddha passed away, they would have been imagining the Buddha. They would have been bringing him to mind. And gradually, as they brought the Buddha to mind, those images in their imaginations would have become more and more illumined. And that, I think this is the mysterious thing, is that that's a two-way thing. So as the disciples themselves were purifying their own minds of self-clinging, of selfishness, so they were becoming more and more receptive to that mysterious dimension beyond the individual, as it were, that dimension would be moving down to them. And kind of as those two things kind of met and intersected, there would be these more illumined images would, you know, the Buddha as, you could have perhaps imagine that they would have seen in their minds the Buddha as golden. I mean, in actuality, he would have been an old 80-year-old, kind of probably quite skinny and kind of withered old man, but in their imaginations he would have become radiant, become golden. Have I got time? Yes. I've got a little bit of another poem I wanted to read you that I think this whole thing of you know, we're reaching up but something's kind of coming down, as it were. Well, it's very mysterious. It's very easy to literalise. It's very easy on one hand to literalise and on the other hand to sort of dismiss, because we don't want to sort of believe in such things. So I think sometimes poetry can sort of help to connect with that. So I thought I'd read you a little bit of this poem by Ted Hughes. It's called New Foal. So it's about this little baby foal. I won't read you the whole thing, but it's about this little baby foal that's just born, and we've just got to the point where he's just struggling up to his feet. And the poem goes, "Soon he'll be almost a horse. He wants only to be horse, pretending each day more and more horse, till he's perfect horse. Then unearthly horse will surge through him, weightless, a spinning of flame under sudden gusts. It will coil his eyeball and his heel in a single terror, like the awe between lightning and thunderclap." So there's something I love about that, that, you know, the little foal, it's making its effort, it's in, it's, he's trying to, you know, he's got this imaginative image of horse, you know, this archetype of horse it wants to be. And then, so he's kind of trying from his end, but then this unearthly horse comes, is going to come surging through him. So that poetically speaks to me very much. And that's what would have been happening in the imaginations of these early disciples. They'd have been imagining the Buddha, and then the Buddha would have been surging through them, as it were. And not only that, something else seems to have happened. That as they contemplated the particular qualities of the Buddha, so perhaps one disciple would have been contemplating the Buddha's fearlessness, another would have been contemplating the Buddha's compassion, the Buddha's energy, and so on. As they contemplated particular qualities, other illumined forms appeared in their imagination. Other different figures. So we've got this particular figure of the Buddha, but you may already have seen other forms, some very different forms in different colours, with different hand gestures, some in male bodies, some in female bodies, and so on. So different forms started to appear. And it seems that sometimes even the same form appeared in the imagination of different disciples. So that's mysterious as well, isn't it? And these are some of the forms that we'll be exploring on this retreat. We'll be creating shrines with the different images of these different forms. We'll be chanting mantras. A mantra is a sound symbol. So you could say just as a statue or a rupa is a visual symbol, or a painting is a visual symbol of the Buddha, a mantra is a sound symbol. We'll be chanting mantras, we'll be hearing talks. Each night we'll have a different talk on different one of these forms, one of these figures. And, well, again, as we've been saying, just really invite you to participate in all these different ways of imagining the Buddha. So to become like the Buddha, we have to imagine the Buddha. Because, well, when we do that, well, we embody the goal in our imagination. And we gather our deepest energies into the image of what we're trying to move towards. As I was saying, these are gateways to our own imagination. It's a bit like reading a poem, like I've just done. So the poet's written the poem from his or her imagination. If they were truly inspired, they probably felt that poem came from a different dimension themselves. Maybe you've had that experience in some creative activity yourself. They might have felt that it came through them in that way. In any case, they've written the poem, we read the poem, and then we're lifted up. It's not just that we enjoy it if it's a really good work of art. We're lifted up. The whole world can look different after engaging with some poetry or some works of art. Certainly I found that. And Yeah, so this was how I made sense of wanting to pray. And this is how I made sense of that I could be a Buddhist and I could still want to pray. So, yeah, just invite you to take part. Just like the poem, in a sense, just as we've got to, you know, we've got to read a poem to really be moved by it, I'd really invite you to take part in this exploration with us over the course of the retreat. So, thank you.